disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, November 13th, 2018. The midterms have come and gone, and already the Democrats have signaled their desire to work with Trump, while even the most progressive sections of the DNC have announced that they have given up on their promise of fighting to abolish ICE, while Nancy Pelosi has stated that her single goal is to protect Obamacare. Meanwhile, despite the eyes of the mainstream media being wrapped up in the dumpster fire of the Trump administration and cooing sweetly over the lukewarm success of the so-called blue wave, autonomous social movements are still in the thick of it, opposing the far right, fighting pipelines, and organizing their communities in the face of drastic climate change, impending economic collapse, and creeping fascism. Just this weekend, we saw the hashtag Outlive Them mobilizations and actions take place in New York, North Carolina, and beyond, as well as anti-fascist counter-demonstrations in Little Rock, Arkansas, Fruitia, Colorado, Tucson, Arizona, and in Toronto and Calgary in so-called Canada. In this episode, we were lucky enough to catch up with anti-fascists involved in the Outlive Them mobilization in New York, where we talk about how anti-capitalists are mobilizing within Jewish and Muslim communities to combat Trumpism in the far right, as well as talking with somebody involved in the Indigenous Anarchist Federation about the counter-mobilization in Tucson, Arizona, where we discuss how the far right is acting in the post-midterm terrain, as well as information about the various caravans coming from Mexico. But first, let's get to the headlines. Republican operative and InfoWars contributor Roger Stone has sent members of the far-right gang the Proud Boys to Florida, an effort to harass largely members of the black community who are protesting the outcome of the recent election while demanding that all votes be counted. IGD will be releasing an interview with somebody on the ground soon, but should be noted that local Florida-based GOP officials have also been caught recently coordinating protests with members of the Proud Boys against Nancy Pelosi several weeks ago, a claim that Republican officials originally denied. Mainstream media reports that upwards of 5,600 troops are currently stationed across the California, New Mexico, and Texas borders, essentially sitting around and putting up razor wire. While Trump has more or less forgotten about the caravan in the wake of the midterms ending, the caravan itself is still hundreds of miles away from the border. Meanwhile, a mass of rabbis within the United States is expected to soon begin a pilgrimage to the U.S. border in protest of Trump administration's policies, while various groups across the U.S. are organizing supply runs in support of the caravan. Meanwhile, new reports show that Trump is on track to surpass Obama in terms of the amount of people on average being held by ICE on a given day, currently almost 45,000. On top of that, the biggest companies housing the majority of these people arrested at the border, corporations like Geo Group, are not only big Trump supporters and donors, but they are also raking in the cash in the form of massive contracts with DHS as they warehouse human beings awaiting immigration trials. The Huffington Post has released a new survey on the housing crisis, which shows its impacts are growing at an alarming rate, even outside of large cities. Many respondents to the survey stated that they choose between meals and paying rent. They put off fixing their cars and paying bills for as long as they can, and many also forgo even having children simply because they can't afford their rent. Meanwhile, even Bloomberg has stated that wages have stagnated while the GDP, or the gross domestic product, has gone up, which explains why we are all working more while getting paid less. Bloomberg writes, quote, "Capitalism isn't working. The U.S. economy is growing, but workers are seeing less and less of the benefits. Since the Great Recession, real gross domestic product per capita has increased substantially, but real compensation per hour, which includes benefits like healthcare, hasn't grown at all." Accelerating this trend has been the growth of both the service and so-called gig economy, coupled with the push towards automation and AI or artificial intelligence-powered technologies, which even White House studies and academics like Stephen Hawking have argued will have massive effects on upwards to or over half of the current workforce, especially impacting those working in more blue-collar fields. But if the idea of not being able to drive a city bus because a robot stole your job isn't scary enough, then perhaps you need to check out a recent UN report that claims we have only 2 years to secure biodiversity and stop the rate of species extinction on the planet before we lock ourselves into a downward spiral of self-destruction we cannot get out of. At this point, thinking that electoralism will produce the gains needed to save humanity and life on this planet isn't just a baseless claim without any empirical or historical evidence. It is a belief instead based on faith in a system that has never worked in our interests, nor ever will. In that spirit, let's get to the news. Wildfires are raging across California. Unicorn Riot and a recent report from Northern California where the campfire has been raging wrote, community volunteers are coordinating ways to help and have organized community mutual aid meetings held nightly at the Blackbird Cafe, a local bookstore and info shop. A group of volunteers has been gathering to figure out ways they can work together in helping the affected. Mutual aid organizing includes efforts to distribute respirators, provide pet livestock evacuation and care, help victims in obtaining lost documents, improvise shelter construction, ride shares out of town, cleanup, ash sifting, free Airbnbs, childcare, donation drives, music benefits, creating contact lists, finding overnight parking accommodations, providing various types of medical and wellness services. AK Press, the anarchist cooperative publishing project whose warehouse is located in Chico, wrote on Twitter, quote, the AK Press collective members in Chico are safe, but as the smoke clears, we'll be supporting ongoing relief efforts and will share information about how you can help beyond the traditional top-down relief models. We appreciate your support, understanding, and patience. Fundraisers are kicking off to cover medical bills still faced by those in Charlottesville stemming from the neo-Nazi Unite the Right rally. The Torch Network is raising money for anti-fascists in Sacramento and Atlanta who were kicked off of PayPal recently. Lastly, Gainesville iWalker incarcerated workers organizing committees also selling a brand new shirt as a benefit for their continued organizing. It is literally fire. Check out our show notes for ways to donate to these awesome fundraisers. In the Twin Cities, North Star Antifa now has a tip line you can call to report fascist activity. You can see the tip line link in our show notes. In Olympia, various groups, including Olympia Solidarity Network and Olympia IWW, have started Mutual Aid Mondays at 7 p.m. at the Billy Frank lot. The event features free cold weather items and free hot food and takes place every Monday at 7 p.m. Red Emma's in Baltimore is turning 14 years old on the 15th of November. Stop by and support them if you can and check out their celebratory event on their birthday. The Tiny House Warriors Camp in so-called British Columbia continues to grow as the camp continues to fight a pipeline project. Follow their struggle on Facebook, linked in our show notes. Starting on November 9th, actions begin in coordination with the Outlive Them campaign, a coordinated effort to center resistance to anti-Semitism in the fight against white supremacy and the far right. To see a list of actions that were announced ahead of time, check out our show notes for a link. Portland, Oregon, there was a banner drop to kick things off. In New York, a march and rally took place. See our interview later in this episode for more information on the report back. In East Oakland, the village land occupation continues as volunteers have stated they need more supplies and help to carry out the takeover of land for homeless people displaced by police evictions. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a pro-Trump troll screamed abuse at the Outlive Them gathering, leading to police arresting one of the anti-fascists. In the Denver, Colorado area, anti-fascist docs James Mason, a disciple of Charles Manson and George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party, and author of the book Siege, which has been promoted by groups like Adam Waffen as a Bible for lone wolf attacks. In Kansas, a riot kicked off at a mental health prison where extensive damage was done to a housing unit. On November 10th, over 100 people turned out in Little Rock, Arkansas to shout down the National Socialist Movement, who could only muster about 12 to 20 people. The rally paid lip service to the conspiracy theory that white farmers in South Africa are being genocided in post-apartheid. The rally marked a return of Matthew Heimbach to the stage of white nationalism, who exited the movement only several months ago after beating his wife in front of his child after she confronted him for having an affair with his mother-in-law. According to the rules of the group that Heimbach formerly led, the Traditionalist Workers' Party, Heimbach would have been put to death for assaulting his wife in such a way. In San Francisco, court proceedings started in the case of the Eugene, Oregon, quote, weed Nazi, who was attempting to sue anti-fascists for exposing her to the wider community. Unicorn Right has a report on the opening of the case linked in our show notes. Tucson, Arizona, anti-fascists and anti-racists outnumbered white nationalists, Proud Boys, militia types, and Patriot Movement members in a counter-demonstration. Hear more about this later in the show. On the same night as the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the day in which Adolf Hitler encouraged his troops and Nazi supporters to attack Jews and their businesses across Germany, Monkey Wrench Books, an anarchist info shop and bookstore in Austin, Texas, had their windows broken out, and the office of the housing justice nonprofit ACE, or A-C-C-E, which has also campaigned heavily this year for rent control in California, was burned down in an arson attack. A benefit for Monkey Wrench Books can be found linked in our show notes. In some positive news, they also recently posted the following, quote, thank you so much to everyone who came out, cleaned up, brought supplies, and donated. We are overwhelmed with the support, and we appreciate folks in the neighborhood checking in. Check out Monkey Wrench Books online and on Facebook for ways to support them. And if you can, please donate. Help them continue to get back on their feet. They're doing fine. They're doing great. But more support is always needed. Meanwhile, in so-called Canada, successful anti-fascist rallies took place in Calgary against the rebel media and in Toronto against anti-Muslim groups. Toronto Against Fascism reports, quote, despite the freezing rain and snow, a small but active crowd stuck with us and we held the southeast corner of the square and blocked the view of any fascists from the passing traffic. So weak were their rally, they could not even attempt to march from their safe space pen Toronto police set up for their comfort and protection. This proved to be their shortest and weakest rally yet. On November 11th, Conflict Minnesota reports that vandalism against local colonial statues continued. See our show notes for links. In Fruitia, Colorado, people marched against a neighbor that flew Nazi and Confederate flags. The event was organized by Black Lives Matter Grand Junction. See our show notes for a video of the march. Meanwhile, Veterans Against the War disrupted an event honoring George W. Bush in Philadelphia, PA. Soldiers kneeled, disrupted the event with chants, and also gave back their medals. On November 12th, rowdy anti-gentrification protests took place in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago. A group of about 80 queer and trans people arrived today in Tijuana as part of one of the recent caravans. People are currently also mobilizing supplies and support. In Los Angeles, people covered the names of celebrities on the Walk of Fame with those killed by police. On November 13th, people held banners commemorating the murder of Mula Geta Sarah at the hands of neo-Nazis in Portland. That is going to do it for us this time. We will see you soon and enjoy the interviews. Don't bother shaking my hand, don't waste your mind. Cause a friend of my enemy is no friend of mine. How dare you sleep at night with all the phone calls you made? For every pay call to do your dirty work, tighter grow the chains around our ankles and our wrists, they bleed for your security. You paved the way for slavery with no apology. Too afraid to be accountable, you hide behind your window panes. We'll be around here fighting for the world we want to see. I don't want to live in a place where neighbors can't just speak. Pit against one another under the guise of liberty. Hiring mercenaries to wage war on our peace. Stealing from the poor so the rich can't sleep. Cop lover, won't you ever brush your teeth? I can smell the bacon on your breath from sucking off the police chief. And as you pleasure him and he enforces your hate, remember all the countless anarchists fighting for the day what brings. I don't want to live in a place that your neighbors can't just speak. Pit against one another under the guise of liberty. Hiring mercenaries to wage war on our peace. Stealing from the poor so the rich can't sleep. All right, we're talking to two people that were out on the streets of New York participating in the Outlive Them demonstrations. There's been a lot happening in New York this past couple weeks leading up to this demonstration. Can you just tell us kind of about what's been going on and what led to this demo?
Yeah, so on October 18th, an international anonymous call went out for Days of Action by Jewish anti-fascists and allies all over the world to commemorate the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht and also to address the rise of fascist violence all over the globe, and to acknowledge the role that anti-Semitism plays in dividing oppressed communities. And here in New York, especially considering the Proud Boy attack that happened in early October, folks from all different tendencies and all different groups felt compelled to come together, call an assembly, and figure out what we were going to do in response. It was a really broad coalition, and we came up with a couple of different actions from Thursday to Sunday, October 8th to October 11th. Oh, sorry, November 8th to November 11th. And the demonstration and memorial service on Saturday was definitely the biggest event of the weekend.
Awesome. Can you just talk about what happened? It seems like there was a bunch of activity with the police. The police were pretty heavily handed, and also there were some Trump supporters that were out there, or people that, looked like they were Trump supporters. They had Trump hats on, and they were trying to mess with the march, too.
Yeah, this is Moshe from Muslim Jewish Anti-Fascist Front and Outlive Them NYC. So our experience on Saturday was actually pretty typical, I think, of a lot of street actions in New York City.
Right.
What was not typical was that most of those street actions that are targeted in this way are have historically been led by communities of color in the city and are targeted as such on an everyday basis. I think this was the first explicit Jewish anti-fascist action in New York City in some time, possibly decades on the scale. And it was targeted in a way that made it very clear that the police were there to protect the fascists, were there to protect the private property on the Upper East Side, were there to protect the Metropolitan Republican Club and the Trumpist thugs who were there to attack us and not to protect anybody else. And they dove in like within 10 minutes and arrested two people, two of our people, within a few minutes of the march starting.
We actually hadn't even stepped off the sidewalk yet. We were still congregating and waiting to begin our march. We had just started chanting, just introducing ourselves to each other, kind of finding our crews. And two people were just snatched and arrested as a show of force. It was a little disorienting, but we regrouped and continued on our route.
Yeah, I mean, for people that don't know, I mean, New York is just notorious for having, you know, not only a lot of police on the streets, but just they make it very hard to march. And if you follow people like Ash J on Twitter, you can see that there's a group that comes together every week, People's Monday, and marches in remembrance of people killed by the police, and just every week they're getting screwed with by the police.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's because that it was you know, under the banner of anti-fascism the police reacted this way, or are they still sour from what happened with the Proud Boys? I mean, they got a lot of bad press over that, or was it a mixture of all these things?
I think it was a mix. I think there were a few, probably a few reasons why the NYPD responded the way it responded. One, it was a multiracial march.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of angry working class people and allies on the Upper East Side, which is the wealthiest and like whitest district in Manhattan. And I think they were very clear about what they were there to do, which is to protect and serve capital and white people. And, you know, three of the people arrested were Jews. One was an indigenous Latinx person. And it was very clear that they were there specifically to maintain the order and property of you know, white supremacy and white people and wealthy people in the streets of New York City, and that they were there to do what they do to racial, religious, sexual, and gender minorities who step out of line.
And can we talk a little bit about the few Trump supporters that were there? They were seen in tweets and online video. They were following the march the whole time, and the police were basically protecting them. And they were, what did they do? Were they harassing the march, yelling at it, or were they trying to actually physically engage with people?
No, this is a group that this is a pretty small group that uh-huh. follows Jewish radical actions all over the city and always shows up pretty much to counter demonstrate. And in this instance, they stayed across the street, across the boulevard or the avenue, pretty much the entire time wherever we were, shouting "fake Jews, coward, hypocrites, traitors," some Trump stuff, and that's all good and fine. And and then we're used to that because they really show up pretty much everywhere that radical Jews do, or left Jews do, or anti-capitalist, anti-fascist Jews do. And so we had our demonstration through the streets of New York City, across Central Park, from the Upper East Side to the Upper West Side, trying to have a presence in a neighborhood where fascists and fascist collaborators live and work and spend their money freely, and also in a largely Jewish neighborhood on the West Side, and give a principled, visible, like affirming anti-fascist Jewish public presence, mm-hmm. And make it really clear. And then wrap up in front of the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial Plaza in Riverside Park, which is the only Holocaust memorial in Manhattan.
Two partisans, two resistance fighters.
So we gathered there. We held a Havdalah service, which marks the end of Shabbat at sundown on Saturday. And we also held a ritual of mourning for the 13 folks who lost their lives to white supremacist violence just 2 weeks ago, as well as to all partisans and anti-fascist fighters who have fallen.
And the 13, the number 13 includes both the 11 who were massacred in Pittsburgh and the two black elders who were gunned down in Louisville.
And when we got to the park, to the river, to Riverside Park, all the way on the west side, we were followed in by a whole long line of cops who then called the Parks Department and called like all the other authorities they possibly could. They stayed towards the back, and while they were there, protected the, they're called the Jewish Defense League, these fascist Jews. They protected them and allowed them to stand there and shout epithets and curses and horrible slogans at us as we were mourning, as we were holding a religious ceremony. Yeah.
And then the indigenous comrade who was arrested basically like as part of a larger group of people who were trying to
de-escalate,
create some space, separate the fascists and the cops from like the mourning crowd of people. And this was to us this was just symbolic of what, or emblematic of what role the authorities play in these situations. And I think it was a testament to our strength and our power that there wasn't more repression of this ritual, which was unpermitted and which did have a mass base of people, multiracial and largely working class, on the west side. And it was an attempt by the fascists to disrupt this ceremony, and I think that attempt failed.
Awesome. Now, I wanted to get your all's thoughts. In the week leading up to this demonstration, there was right after the Pittsburgh massacre, people were outside of the GOP office where Gavin McInnes was with the Proud Boys, and there were protests. There were numerous arrests. Then, of course, in Pittsburgh, when Trump came, there were massive demonstrations. Trump's motorcade had to turn around. And then after the election, there was a demonstration of about 12 people outside of Tucker Carlson's house. And the Democrats, people like Stephen Colbert, really kind of came out with this really, again, with this civility talk. And I'm just curious, it seemed like there was a trajectory where it was like, especially after the Proud Boy attack, of really trying to connect between the street level fascists and the alt-right and the GOP. And it seems like when it got to Tucker Carlson's house, all of a sudden that just, then all of a sudden we're back talking about civility and all that stuff. And I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
So yes, I think the Tucker Carlson action and the Outlive Them actions over the weekend, which happened in all these different cities, were some of the first street actions after the election. And I think the battle lines have been drawn even more clearly since Tuesday, in terms of who is going to stand with us and who's going to have our backs and who's not. And if people's primary concern right now is civility or the ability of rich people to basically conduct themselves however they want to on private property that was stolen from indigenous people with the labor of black and brown people, that's fine. But that makes it clear to us that which side they're on, because there are children in concentration camps and there are Jews being gunned down in synagogues. And I think it's pretty clear right now to us who has our backs and which side everybody's on based on how they respond to what's happening in the streets. And if they're not on the side of anti-fascists and they're not on the side of street mobilization, then they might as well just come out and say they're on the side of the fascists.
And to speak to that a little bit more, at our first assembly for the Outlive Them New York City Coalition, we spent a good chunk of time up front talking about what was missing from the response from the Jewish left after Pittsburgh and what was not fulfilled in us as anti-fascist, anti-capitalist, you know, whatever, communist, socialist, anarchist, whatever people are identifying as, activists and the organizers, and moving beyond voting and moving beyond relying on Jewish establishment institutions and moving beyond the nonprofit industrial complex to have a community-driven response to fascist violence in our streets. And although the pogrom that occurred 2 weeks ago has not yet occurred in New York to the Jewish community, there is lots of other fascist violence that we see. We see swastikas all over. We see folks walking around with, you know, emblems and tattoos and sweatshirts and t-shirts and, you know, all the signifiers of the groups that they're part of that seek to exterminate us. And there is a big contingency of Jews, I know, in New York, and I'm pretty sure all over, that are ready to get organized and fight back in complete, deep-rooted solidarity with the other oppressed communities around us.
Awesome. Yeah, just, you know, in closing, I just wanted to ask, you know, even since Pittsburgh, we know of, I think there was a attack on a Muslim family's home and also an attempted pipe bomb attack on a mosque, and also everything that happened in New York. And then at the, in Chapel Hill at the Outlive Them rally, there was
it was awful.
Yeah. A Trump supporter that came out there and just tried to disrupt and attack people. And the police responded by attacking or arresting somebody from the anti-fascist demonstration.
Right.
And I mean, it just seems, I mean, all the trajectories we've seen already are just going to continue, you know, after the election. And it might even push some of these people, because there was, you know, the quote unquote blue wave that happened.
Yep.
It might push some of these people even more into a destabilized position where they feel like acts of, you know, lone wolf violence are the only way forward. And I'm just curious, you know, with that in mind, any thoughts you have on the ways that people should organize?
Well, I would just add, we have a pretty strong network of Muju anti-fascists, that is Muslims and Jews, who are in touch and in communication and in coordination for how to respond when violence erupts against one of our communities
across the country,
right? Across the country and in a couple other countries. And I think a lot of us are realizing that Christian nationalism is a real threat to both of us. Our communities are not the real threat. And I think we've been told a lot of times Muslims need to fear Jews need to fear Muslims. But through collective action, through actually working together against the fascist threat, we're forging the ties and building the links that we need in order to effectively defend ourselves, whether it's from a lone wolf attack or from state violence, institutional violence against any of our communities.
Also recognizing that, I mean, it felt really, I can speak for myself, that it felt really, really dope this weekend to know that we were engaged in action and solidarity with people all over the world, from Switzerland, Poland, Germany, Australia, Canada, West Coast, occupied Palestine, you know, Texas, St. Louis, Chicago, New England, Portland and Seattle. So there was a lot of internetwork communication that was facilitated by the folks who put out this anonymous call. And it seems like it's going to be an ongoing thing. So I think something that was stressed in our organizing assemblies, and I feel like was stressed in the international call as well, is that this response to the global rise of, you know, fascist violence in this historical moment really needs to be international. And yeah, and that folks should plug in because this network is growing. I think the response that we saw this weekend speaks to a need that anti-fascist Jews have been feeling for a while, and I'm glad it's gotten a kickstart.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to speak with us, and you know, great to see everything in New York. It's great to hear that things are building. Anything else you want to say, or any social media links or things like that that people should be checking out?
Sure. So one thing I just wanted to add is we are in total and unconditional solidarity with other communities in struggle, not just Jewish and Muslim communities, but Black and Brown communities, queer and trans communities, any communities that are under attack by the same forces that seek our extermination. And we are working with Shut It Down NYC, with People's Mondays, with folks from different migrant solidarity groups and solidarity with the caravan, and with migrants and refugees everywhere. And there are ways that folks can do this work wherever they are, in a way that recognizes how connected, you know, the enemy is. We need to be just as connected and more so with each other. So if folks want to follow what we're doing, there's a local platform at Outlive Them NYC on Twitter, and then Bookface, and there's a global platform which is just Outlive Them, I think they can be reached at We Will Outlive Them at protonmail.com.
Awesome. Hey, thanks a lot. Take care and best of luck to y'all.
Thank you.
We hope that you are enjoying this episode of This Is America, or the latest episode of the It's Going Down podcast. We know that a growing number of the proletarian community tune in every week to hear both resistance news and the latest headlines on everything from climate change to Trump.
Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell!
But before you fast forward that dial...
Hell no, it can't wait! Your lives will be affected!
We bring you a special announcement. We need your help this winter in meeting our fundraising goal of $10,000. So if you don't want to see IGD slowing down anytime soon,
say hell no, motherfuckers!
Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Give us a one-time donation, buy some awesome swag, or sign up to become a monthly supporter.
Now, I want you to go in that bag and find my wallet.
Which one is it?
It's the one that says bad motherfuckers.
And now, back to the show. You just want to introduce yourself real quick?
Yes, I'm Insurgent E. I'm from out in the middle of nowhere in Arizona.
Okay, cool. Are you repping any group or crew, or just yourself?
Basically, I'm just kind of representing myself. I'm a part of the Indigenous Anarchist Federation. But basically, this was a group of several different people that got together this weekend, and I was joining them from out of town, so...
Awesome. So what happened in so-called Tucson? We understand that there was a group called the Arizona Patriot Movement. They've kind of been in the news. Some of their members went to a mosque recently, I think in Phoenix, and encouraged their kids to like vandalize it and steal stuff. I mean, just... And also they recorded the whole thing. I mean, they just look like total fools. Also, they had like Antonia Foreman out to speak. Antonia Foreman is Baked Alaska's bodyguard that managed to get himself stabbed in Los Angeles, California. Was also at Unite the Right. I mean, he's been very clear that his whole thing is basically, you know, mainstreaming neo-Nazism through Trump circles. But so,
oh yeah, he got
so tell us about what was going on in Tucson.
Basically, it's kind of like you laid out, this group, which is kind of a Phoenix-based group, but they get people to come from all over the Southwest to come to their events and rep them. They do lots of border work, and by border work, I mean going out in the desert and quote unquote hunting. They're pretty much a straightforward fascist group that's organizing around specifically Donald Trump, but they're also just a nationalist group that's trying to gain momentum. And they managed to draw a decent amount of people this weekend, but they also drew quite a bit of resistance. We had people coming resisting from all over the state, all over the Southwest. There's a good indigenous presence. We had some Diné, some Odom, and some Yuman people out there. And it was a very successful event, I think, because of the wide variety of tactics that were employed during the counter protest.
What were the numbers like on each side?
It was probably a 1.5 or a 2-to-1 ratio as far as protest. It happened in a family park, so I mean, there was like a birthday party happening right next to where this fascist gathering was going on. There was a lot of the community actually walked over and was just kind of confused at what was going on. And as soon as they found out that there was a nationalist meeting up there, they actually joined in and started taking part in it. So
awesome. And you were saying there was a diversity of tactics. What all happened?
Well, I think that what the Tucson group did really fantastic was they basically allowed people to participate in whatever way they felt comfortable. So there were people masked up, being militant, being in their face, making sure that, these tatted up Nazis that were walking up weren't going to be directly assaulting people, making sure that people of color were, when they were targeted, that there was a resistance there that would help protect them and help make sure that they felt safe. There was also a literature distribution table that had free cookies, both vegan and non-vegan. And man, everybody they ate those up. They enjoyed them. There were free stickers and stuff that little kids were taking and putting, fascist free zone stickers around town. So it was a nice array of tactics. The noise demonstration, I think, was by far the most successful, just because as the fascists were packing up, they were very, very loudly complaining to the police that things were too loud and that they were going to file a complaint with the city because protesters were too loud. So
it was the freedom of speech was just so loud that they just couldn't handle it.
Exactly.
Isn't that funny? I'd like to complain to the government that the free speech that these people are using is just so loud. Oh.
Well, the funniest thing was the main guy who was part of the organizers for this, he was one of those complaining. And as he was complaining very loudly about this, basically one of the police officers said, you know what, we've warned him enough, grab him. And they took him out and arrested him for assaulting a National Lawyers Guild observer. So.
And that was the only arrest, which was
on him.
That was the only arrest, correct? Was somebody on the Trump fascist side?
Exactly. So the whole point of this rally was supposedly to stand against leftist hate, leftist violence, all of this stuff. But the only violence that was committed, the only person arrested for violence, of course, was one of their organizers. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think this weekend's really interesting. I mean, there's been all this controversy about the protest at Tucker Carlson's house, which was like 12 people standing outside his house with signs. But I mean, this weekend kind of showed, where we're at after the midterms. And I'm just curious, watching these far right groups, Trump supporters, fascists, I mean, do you see, have they been growing at all? Have they been kind of struggling to kind of keep members from coming out, or are they growing right now?
So I think the biggest thing is that their numbers have, from what I've been told, have been maintained and consistent in the Tucson area. There's been a big shift in tactics, though. So basically what they're trying to do is cultivate a friendlier image. For example, the Proud Boys that attended were told by the organizers not to wear any Proud Boy regalia.
Huh.
So it's kind of a shift that they're trying to do. It was very much about red, white, and blue America. We only saw a few people that had any type of like Kekistan-affiliated stuff, but it was extremely limited. I think that they're trying to rebrand as red, white, and blue nationalists instead of alt-righters. So I think that's the biggest shift. They also have been trying to really shift the focus, claiming that, the left wing or leftists in general are violent. And what we've actually seen is that they've actually been de-escalating their militancy in some ways. For example, this protest, they got themselves in this big cage. There was only one entrance in and out. It was surrounded by steel fences and police basically patrolling the only entrance and exit, which funnily enough, even some liberals were like, that's a pretty poor tactical decision on their part. I mean, when a liberal knows it's bad tactics, you know it's bad.
Right.
Also, they've been like downplaying their open carry. So all of them, of course, were open carrying pistols. A lot of leftists were as well.
Huh.
But the organizers told people not to carry rifles. And that's a big departure from what you've seen in the past in Arizona. Usually people are rocking ARs and AKs on the Patriot side.
Right, yeah, totally.
But they're playing down that as well.
Now, do you think that is done because they're worried about how it's going to look in the media, or they're trying to appeal to supporters to come out, and they're trying to downplay kind of more of an aggressive image to get more people to come out on their side?
I don't think it's that much, because when it comes to their actual like Facebook page and other things like that, you know, you guys see them with AKs and ARs and everything else. I mean, they're still promoting that militancy, and I think that's actually a big draw for a lot of their supporters. What I think it really is a media optics battle. Is they're trying to play the leftists or the violent ones card, and it's hard for them to do that when they're outgunning and outarming anybody that comes to protest them. So I think that's the primary reason they're doing that.
Interesting. I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, everything that's happening with these various caravans that are coming up from Honduras to the United States. I believe some people just arrived in Tijuana today. I'm just curious your thoughts on, you know, how it's been playing out.
Yeah, I think that the whole terminology caravan is the way that the right is trying to change the perspective on quote-unquote invaders. I think that a caravan is a very useful way for them to discuss this, because it sounds organized, it sounds like a mass movement that is, you know, has leaders, has designated targets. Whereas in the past, when they talked about migration, they generally talked about the flood at large or things like that. So I think that that's the way that they're kind of shifting this focus. And I think the caravan's been a really useful tool for the right to basically develop an appeal to people, to make them think, oh no, there's these people coming and there's malice behind it. From an indigenous perspective, you know, migration's the border's fake. Migrations have happened since the beginning of time. The Aztecs came from what we would today call the American states, and vice versa. Lots of people have immigrated north from what today is called Mexico. So I think that it's a big duty for people to basically try to provide material support for these people that are coming. It's difficult to do because, you know, we do have a lot of legal systems here in the United States that are preventing these people from claiming asylum and actually coming here, and basically getting them across the border is the big challenge at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, this is nothing compared to, you know, what climate change is going to, unfortunately, predictably produce in terms of climate refugees.
I completely agree with that, because, I mean, we're already seeing the effects of climate change here in Arizona, and I think that it's ironic that the people that are protesting these caravans are talking about the displacement of quote-unquote American patriots, which is code for white people, but at the same time, they're not really thinking about the fact that Arizona is undergoing one of the largest water crises in centuries. Going back in the geologic record, you know, this is the biggest crisis in centuries, and that our populations are bigger than they've ever been, ever, in Arizona's history. So climate change is the real threat, and it's going to cause the most pain for people here in Arizona. Migrants coming and going is not going to be the big issue. It's climate change is really going to be hitting us hard over the next century.
Yeah, and it's ironic too that they chant "lock her up" and, you know, they hate Hillary. But from our understanding, it was, you know, Hillary and the Democrats that helped overthrow, you know, the Honduras regime and institute the current government, which led to these people, you know, being forced to flee their country. You would think that if they hated Hillary so much, they'd be in solidarity with these people that have been, you know, repressed under, you know, their current government and are trying to come to the United States.
Exactly. I mean, that's the big thing with U.S. policy under Bush, Obama, and Trump, they've all been creating these crises in Central America that have been driving people north. You know, people don't leave their homeland because it's an easy thing to do or because it's a fun thing to do. They're leaving their homeland.
Right.
They have no options. And, yeah, I mean, I think that was the funniest thing about this whole rally is a lot of people were saying, you know, go home, Democrat. And several people were yelling back, you know, you know, Obama can go to hell or, you know, Obama, things like that. And it really confused them. They just did not know what to make of that because they're still under the impression that the caravan and any anti-fascist protester, you know, in the pocket of Hillary or something like that.
So. Yeah, well, they can't give that up because then their whole, you know, worldview and their whole, you know, talking points start to degrade. But, I mean, it just shows you that, I mean, if these people actually had an analysis and had, like, you know, an actual politic that they wanted to speak to, that, you know, if they were actually opposed to the Democratic Party and, quote-unquote, globalism, you know, that they would see that, you know, people displaced by neoliberal regimes and also, you know, global capital would be people that they would want to be in solidarity with. But I mean, you know, as we all know, I mean, you know, they're not actually in solidarity with any of the social movements, you know, that are, and people that are being displaced by ISIS or attacked by Mexican drug cartels. You know, they don't care about any of that stuff. I mean, really, this is just a, you know, a veil to promote, you know, settler colonial white democracy.
Yeah, that's definitely something that we're trying to counter here, because this whole movement, the Arizona Patriot Movement and affiliated movements across the state, are truly dangerous to both people of color here in the state, indigenous people here in the state, and also migrants, because these people are arming, they are going out into the desert, they spend a lot of time out there completely unoccupied with full support of the Border Patrol. And, you know, with the large amount of bodies that are being found out in the deserts of Arizona and across the U.S.-Mexico border, you know, these people, they need to be put in check and they need to be countered, not only when they organize these protests in cities, but also when they're trying to organize and actually conduct operations in the desert. So that's the big ongoing struggle.
Yeah.
Because they've got the state backing them up, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the golden question for our age right now. It's just, you know, this, you know, three-way fight. But I'm just curious, can you comment at all on, you know, the militias and the Patriot Movement? I mean, are you seeing a lot of active movement towards the border to get ready for these caravans if indeed they do reach it?
So there's a lot of chatter about that in right spaces, about mobilizations, about people going out there. Now, whether that's actually going to translate to a large-scale militia deployment along the border, it's kind of hard to say because a lot of these people are just talk, and when it actually comes to being in the desert for long periods of time, they really don't have the guts to tough it out. But at the same time, you know, that's something that we're monitoring, we're keeping track of. I mean, we've got, you know, active duty U.S. soldiers being deployed right now. We're trying to figure out exactly where these deployments are happening. We know that from interactions with the Border Patrol that they are keeping tabs of the caravan or redeploying assets to basically where the caravan is going. That's what's coming from the executive branch right now. But I think that militia deployments typically go where they can afford to go, and so they're a little bit less organized in exactly, you know, where they're going to be targeting.
Right. You know, one last question. I think a lot of people right now are really asking the question, how can people, you know, autonomous social movements, groups, be in solidarity with these caravans?
I think the biggest thing, especially for people that live within driving distance of the border, is basically to try to create material conditions to help them out. So, you know, gathering supplies, foods, things like that, or just gathering cash resources, going across the border and buying resources there for the people. I think that's probably the biggest thing you can do right now to help. Other than that, it's becoming increasingly difficult. You know, it used to be in the past that people could get across the border and claim asylum once they're already here. Now the new directive is only at ports of entry. So it's a little bit more difficult to maybe help people to cross the border or to provide them resources in the desert. We still have comrades out here doing that, providing water, providing first aid out in the desert, but as far as helping the caravans, I think just getting the materials that they need and trying to also get them the legal advice that they need. I mean, we got to help them in the ways that they're requesting. So.
Yeah, very much so. Hey, very appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. It's been very enlightening.
Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you some more down the road.
How can we imagine a world beyond prisons and police, borders and surveillance?
Rust Belt Abolition Radio is an abolitionist media and movement building project based in Detroit, Michigan.
Each monthly episode amplifies the voices of those impacted by mass incarceration and explores ongoing work in the movement to abolish the carceral state and racial capitalism.
Tune in to Rust Belt Abolition Radio here on the Channel Zero Network and visit www.rustbeltradio.org to learn more.
Okay, once again, we're joined with somebody from Rose City Antifa. We're going to be talking about a mass mobilization that's coming up on the 17th along with Philadelphia. There is also a large demonstration that's going to be happening in Portland, Oregon. Joey Gibson and his brand of goons are coming back to the city that they don't live in. They're going to be holding kind of a bizarre rally. Can you just speak to it? What are they rallying about this time?
Well, the purported goal of their rally is to take part in this Hymn 2 movement, which is really a reactionary movement against the number of rape allegations that have been made recently against prominent political figures and celebrities and so on and so forth. I think they were inspired, you know, a lot by the campaign to make Kavanaugh not be confirmed as Supreme Court justice. But really what this is giving them an opportunity to do is kind of bring out of the woodwork all these lingering traits of misogyny and other forms of cultural reactionaryism that are present in the far right movement, and let them rally around this kind of, kind of gross violence and celebration of anti-feminism that they have.
Right. I mean, the rally itself is actually being billed as hashtag him too. And we're going to talk about some of the characters that are going to come out and kind of just their background. But real quick, once again, there will be like a mass mobilization from Pop Mob, and they have a couple events that are coming up. And also anti-fascists will be rallying as well. Can you just talk about the community response to this latest Patriot Prayer event?
Yeah, I think a lot, like a lot of the other Patriot Prayer events that have happened over the last couple years, the goal here is really as a community to come together and say that this sort of hate, this sort of violence, this sort of far-right agitation is not welcome in our communities, and to speak out against it. I know that's kind of the deal with Pop Mom's event, is they're having a survivor speak out that is going to allow people to say, no, actually, rape culture in our society, misogyny in our society is a real problem. It's not a myth. It's a very real thing, and we need to fight against it. And then the anti-fascist groups that are coming out, including Rose City Antifa, our goal is basically to shut it down as much as possible, to defend our community against this sort of these sorts of white nationalists and far right groups that are coming in and threatening people with just these kinds of events.
And I know Rose City Antifa has written extensively about this, but there's an article up on their website that specifically talks about the organizer of Hymn 2, and it's a woman. Can you just talk about her background and why she's important to mention?
Yeah, Haley Adams is a white nationalist here in Portland. She has kind of been a hanger-on with Patriot Prayer for a long time now, and this is her first real event that she's trying to organize on her own and trying to kind of make a name for herself as an organizer on par with Joey Gibson or other figures like that. Her politics are pretty much just completely gross and disgusting. You know, like she has proposed curb stomping in immigrants just the kind of worst kinds of things that you can imagine. She's taken part in the It's Okay to Be White campaign, which people may or may not know is a front that was started on 4chan in order to provide a foot in the door for white nationalism and these sorts of counter diversity campaigns. And she's being joined in this by Quincy Franklin, who is a member of the Street Preachers here in Portland, which is a group that goes out and they bring this kind of bigoted misogyny to Pride, to all kinds of feminist marches. They're well known around town for harassing people and attacking people at those sorts of events.
But this kind of fits right into their playbook and having a woman kind of at the front of this so they can kind of deflect any charges of, you know, oh, you're just a bunch of misogynists, which of course they are.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty typical for things that they do. They tend to have somebody out there as kind of like a spokesperson that is supposed to deflect charges of misogyny, anti-feminism, or racism. But then, you know, when we look at the sorts of things that they do, the sorts of stuff that they post, and the people that are involved with the various groups, the reality is something totally counter to, you know, their attempts to sway the narrative in that way. I mean, we can look at the sorts of people that are expected to come to this event. There, you know, there's a number of Proud Boys with a history of domestic violence, a history of assaulting women. You know, Quincy Franklin was seen at Pride in Seattle in 2017 saying, quote, "Some women deserve to be raped." You know, that's the people that are coming out to this thing. So really the fact that a woman is organizing it is really meaningless in terms of the overall disgusting and dangerous nature of what they're trying to do.
Well, just real quick, I mean, there's again, this article that's up on Rose City Antifa, which we'll link to. But I mean, this like really goes into depth that a lot of these people that are really heavily involved in these circles, both Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys, do have a history of domestic violence, have a history of violence against women specifically, including their romantic partners. Can you just speak to this?
Yeah, you know, some of the people that are involved here have serious documented records of violence. You know, there's some of the Proud Boys, like Mark Ruprecht is one from Seattle. He has a history of you know, domestic violence with his partner that's been documented through the court system, and we've posted evidence of that. There's Nick Bowling, another Proud Boy from Seattle, who attacked a woman once he was kicked out of a bar. You know, there's just like numerous instances that we've documented in our article on our website that shows just who these sorts of people are and the real threat that they pose to the community.
For anybody that's listening to this that wants to come out, you know, what is the basic rally points or the times that people can show up on Saturday?
We're meeting downtown right outside of Terry Shrunk Plaza. The Pop Mob event is in Chapman Park, which is right across the street from Terry Shrunk, and that's probably where the Antifa groups will form up and meet up as well. And the time on that is noon on Saturday is when we're meeting. And we encourage everybody to come out, whether, you know, people want to are people that want to take part in the block or not. It's really important for everybody in the community to come out and say that we oppose this, that this sort of thing has no place in our city, and our community is not going to stand by and be threatened by these kinds of gatherings and have this sort of intimidation carry out with no response.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.
My girl's got pressure. My girl's got pressure. One trip, I can make a mistake, pressure. One trip, we can make a mistake, hail. One trip, we can make a mistake, pressure. My